Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 100, Sushi Go. Today we are joined by Phil Walker Harding, most known for Imhotep, Baron Park, Gizmos, Sushi Go, and oh my god, so many other designs. I'm so excited for you to be the big 100 and on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm very honored to be here for number 100.
You haven't listened to all the episodes, but every time I get asked, who do you wish was on the show? You were always number one. So I saved you for 100.
Oh, that's lovely.
Well, for anyone who doesn't know you, I would love to know, and they would love to know, how did you get started at game designing?
It goes back quite a while now. So in about 2004-5, when I was at university, I got into modern board games. So Settlers, Carcassonne, and like straight away, I was like, I want to design these, which I think was probably just dormant kid game designer Phil coming back. Because when I was really little, me and my brother and my cousin used to make silly, stupid board games together. You know, I was in my 20s now, and I was like, it just came back straight away. So as soon as I sort of discovered the German game design thing, it just became my new hobby. I just started doing it for fun. And then that led to me deciding to self-publish a little game called Archaeology, which I just handmade, basically. That was my first kind of release. Eventually, Z-Man Games picked that up, and it just kind of built slowly, very, very slowly from there.
That's so awesome. I know I definitely made some what you called kind of stupid, silly games when I was a kid. Granted, it wasn't me working with other people. It was me making it and having my cousins and siblings play it.
We were lucky that we all wanted to play and make, so we didn't annoy each other too much. We made some silly things. It's funny how that desire to make games was always there. It was just board games. Going through my teen years, I was like everyone else, playing video games. Guess board games weren't that interesting anymore. But then as soon as I discovered, what, there's these new games that are actually designed by creative people and have amazing new takes on how you can spend an hour together around a table, like it blew my mind that it was happening. I instantly got back into the hobby. So started creating again too, I guess.
Sushi Go is our spotlight for this episode, and it's the one that you're probably most known for and has multiple different variations, and you just had your 10th anniversary for it. But where did the initial inspiration for that game come from?
Yeah, so until about 2014-ish, I was still just self-publishing myself, small print runs. And Archaeology was my first one, and it was kind of this little set collection card game. And I always wanted to do another set collection card game to kind of follow it up. And so for like the 6 years in between it was, 5 or 6 years, I was like banging my head against a wall trying to come up with a new cool filler set collection game. Nothing was very good. And then I played a card game called Fairy Tale from Japan, which as far as I know is the first like pick and pass draft in a hobby game that I am aware of. So I played that. And then not too long after that, Seven Wonders came out. Antoine Bowser's game. And I was like, wow, this mechanism is so inherently fun. But both games are kind of a bit of a hard teach to like super casual players. And so I just set myself the design challenge. Can I make a pick and pass kind of drafting game that is like absolutely kind of entry level? I kind of set myself that design brief and I just kind of got to work. And then I found that all the kind of failed set collection ideas I'd had, a lot of those scoring ideas and ideas for different sets, I could kind of use in Sushi Go all of a sudden. So it kind of was a culmination of a whole lot of work, but it came from those two games. Yeah, Fairy Tale and Seven Wonders.
So what made you decide on the sushi theme?
Yeah, well, I didn't have a theme at the very beginning, and I made one really quick prototype, And I think I just put like baked goods on the card, so like donuts, cake, pie. And I was like, well, this is a bit arbitrary. And I remember asking myself, what's a thing in the real world that goes around a table, like we're passing our hands of cards around a table? And I thought, I think I must have had sushi that day at a sushi train. And I was like, oh, a sushi train goes around. And you're kind of grabbing stuff off the sushi train. And I was like, that's perfect. So from the second prototype, the sushi theme was there and fit really well.
For anyone who has not played Sushi Go, would you mind explaining how the game is played and won?
Yeah, so there's basically a deck of cards, which have all sorts of different types of sushi on them that score in different ways. And there's three rounds to the game. And each round you get dealt a hand of cards. And each turn you pick one card to keep in your collection and then you pass your hand to the left. So the hands of cards go around the table and each turn you get a hand, you pick a card, you pass it on. Then at the end of the round, you score what you've collected and you do that three times. And then whoever has the most points wins.
The thing I love about this game is it's so simple to teach. Just immediately, I have given this game out to so many people that have never really played board games beyond like the traditional Monopoly or Sorry or Candyland. So that was really fun. Did you, while designing it, like start with more mechanics, or was it always that dirt simple?
No, it was always that simple. I knew I wanted it to be play a card, it's yours, and it scores at the end of the round. That's it. Seven Wonders and Fairy Tale have like a few other steps and a few other things to think about. And I knew from the beginning, it was just like, nah, you take a card, it's yours, and it scores. And so the whole design was really all about what are the cards, you know, like I was pretty locked into that structure and I was like, but what are the cards? How do they score? How are they interesting? So that was most of the kind of iteration was that.
And so then how did playtesting look for the game?
Yeah, it's funny you mention easy to teach because, I mean, that's something I always strive for in my games, that the teach is very quick. But with Sushi Go, I remember I was onto something when I was running a playtesting session and someone arrived like 5 minutes into a game and they just watched us finish the game. And then they sat down to play the next round and I started teaching it and they said, oh, you don't need to teach me because they just watched.
I've got this.
Yeah. And I was like, oh. And since then, I've kind of used that as a little bit of a little litmus test for how easy a game is to teach. It's like, can someone watching half a game pick it up? But no, playtesting was just like a lot of games with really slight changes to what the cards are and how many there are in the deck. So it seems really simple when you look at the deck makeup now. But I remember obsessing over, should there be 14 or 16? Should there be 6 points for the most or 5 points for the most? And all those things kind of did end up making quite a lot of difference. But that was most of what the playtesting was kind of nutting out.
I was going to say, were a lot of those decisions that you maybe had changed or adapted into like the base game later on put into Sushi Go Party?
No. I feel like after I designed the first game, an expansion or anything else had never occurred to me that it might happen. And I feel like I'd found the only cards that worked. You know, I found the ones that worked and I put them in Sushi Go and that was it. And so when GameRide asked for a sequel, I kind of pitched to them, how about I do like a big box version with all these new cards? I was like, I don't know what they are. I don't know if there are any that will work. I had to go and find them all. Designing Sushi Go Party was a really fun time, but it was also a huge challenge because I know, again, the cards all seem super simple when you look at them, but to invent them out of thin air at that point, I found really hard. And I tried a million different things and settled on those ones. But no, they were all new for Sushi Go Party.
How did you end up with Game Right?
So it's like very, very fortunate turn of events. So when I was designing Sushi Go, I remember thinking to myself, so Game Right used to have this really, well, they still do have this really great line of just small card games. So I was playing a lot of Loot and, of course, Sleeping Queens and Rat-A-Tat-Cat are in that line too. And I kind of used that as my template for the sort of the type of game I was making. So two decks, 110 cards max, fits in a little box. And so I just had that in the back of my mind that this is kind of like a Game Right game. So I self-published the first edition of Sushi Go, ran a really small crowdfunding campaign for, this was before Kickstarter was available in Australia. So I did it on Indiegogo and I got a bit of money and I did my own first print run. And then one of those just happened to land in someone's hands at Jason Schneider's game group. And Jason Schneider, he was Game Right pretty much, and he was the one who found the game. And so he emailed me and he said, hey, Phil, you don't know me, but I just played this game at Game Night. Could we publish it? And I was like, it was a very, like, probably the most important moment in my game design career. And one of those moments that I suppose at some point I might have decided to pitch to them, but I was so new to the scene, I didn't really know how to pitch very, very much back then either. So it was really, yeah, I feel very fortunate that he got the game, liked it, and just emailed me, and that was it. It was amazing. Some advice I give to people sometimes now when they're starting out is, I think there's something in that designing your game, almost designing it for a publisher in a way, is a good way to help you think through what is the product I'm making, not just the game, but like, who is this for? What sort of line of games might this fit in? I sort of find that a very helpful thing to think through at the start. And I think it kind of paid off with Sushi Go.
It's also nice that a lot of companies are starting to standardize their box sizes and their card counts, especially for small card games. So it's easier to fit into different products and kind of adjust your design accordingly.
Yeah, and like even like Button Shy's little 18 card games, that's such a cool little like thing to exist for a designer, because you kind of can think, oh, there's a publisher out there that wants 18 cards. That's a little design challenge. That's something to kind of, you know, structure what you might want to do. So yeah, I agree. It's really cool.
So, okay, Sushi Go Party. You pitched that. You figured out what cards to put inside of it. What made you decide to go with like, hey, here's all the different like party sets versus just throwing a bunch of different cards and tell people to mix and match?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it was Dominion, basically. So like when Dominion came out, obviously the first like deck building game that started a whole genre. But the other thing Dominion did, which I think a lot of people don't think about as much, is Dominion did this thing of like, here's 25 things, pick 10 of them to play in your game, and every game you can kind of mix and match from that 25. And I just found this like amazing. Like it made Dominion feel like I'd bought, you know, 10 different games at once, and I just loved experimenting with the different decks. So that was the big influence where I thought the Sushi Go system is so simple, it's not that hard to make it sort of plug and play, so to speak. And that just, inspired by Dominion, I just thought, I'm going to try and make as many cards as I can. And I just started designing them. With Game Right, we just talked back and forth about how many sets there could be, what sort of box size we're talking. And it just kind of slowly, I started trying to fill up that box with stuff.
So how did the other games come about then, like Sushi Roll and Sushi Go, Spin Some Dim Sum? Were those like you also pitched to them? Like, hey, I have this other idea for the line. Or was it they came to you and they're like, hey, do you got anything else?
Yeah, so Sushi Roll, the very first thing they ever asked for, not too long after Sushi Go came out, was, could you do a dice game? I hadn't designed anything with dice ever. So I was kind of like, oh, I don't know. So I kind of started work on a dice game, couldn't get it done, couldn't figure it out. I tried three or four different entire approaches to a Sushi Go dice game, sort of gave up. And went back and said, I don't think I've got a dice game in me. I'm really sorry. And then we started talking about Sushi Go Party. But then, like years later, so it was, 2019, I believe it came out. So that's like 6 years or 5 years later, I suddenly it clicked what the dice game had to be, which was there needs to be heaps of dice in the game. And you're passing the dice around the table just like you would pass the cards around the table. And when that clicked, then the design came quite quickly. And then I pitched it back to them and said, hey, you mentioned a dice game ages ago. How about this one? So that's Sushi Roll. Spin Sum for Dim Sum is actually not designed by me. So in later years, Buffalo Games bought Game Right, and they were approached by Ken Gruhl with the design for Spin Sum for Dim Sum. It wasn't Sushi Go themed, and they thought it would fit in the line. And so that's how that happened.
That's so interesting, because not every designer works on everything under their umbrella of game, but how did it feel for you to have like a game under the Sushi Go title that you didn't work on?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, when you've worked with a publisher for a long time, I should say the designer is Ken Gruhl and Quentin Weir. Because I had such a good relationship with Game Right and Buffalo, I suppose some part of me thought, oh, I'd love to. It'd be nice if every Sushi Go thing was mine. Because I did feel some ownership of the kind of brand. But at the same time, when you have a good relationship with a publisher who has made good decisions along the way, I generally find I want to like trust that relationship and sort of go with them, so to speak. So I was quite happy to trust their judgment on that. and I think the game's cool, so I didn't mind. And I don't think, even though I feel very connected to the brand, I think a lot of people who play Sushi Go don't think about me, don't know who I am and don't think about me or my name. So it's not that huge a deal. And in this case, I was quite happy to let the publisher kind of take the lead for that, for the line.
It's so interesting because I guess with this one, at least on the like game design side, for like most designers, when they're kind of learning what it is to be a game designer and what are like some of the mechanics, Sushi Go is one of those things that always gets offered up in the like, here's the toolbox. Try like for a basic set collection or like pick and pass. Normally it's Sushi Go. That is the go-to. And so I find that interesting. Yes, the average human will not care who make games. I mean, people don't even realize that's a job. I didn't know that was a job until like a few years ago.
The other thing I think is, in the case of Sushi Go, like GameRight, they are the ones who branded it. I mean, the name was mine, but the artwork by Naan is something they sourced, and Naan did a great job. And like, all that's their work. Like, if I had created an IP, you know, like world building IP, and they wanted to play in that space, that might be a bit different. But it's like, Sushi Go's really there. Like, they made it so big. So it felt like, I don't really own the Sushiverse. So
the Sushiverse, I love it.
So it would be a bit different, I think, if other designers wanted to work in, I think this would come up way more in like RPGs and other places where, you know, there's so much more IP the designer has kind of contributed. But here I was like, oh yeah, like other people can play in the Sushiverse, that's fine.
That's awesome. And so for the original game, how long do you think it took from that initial inspiration, or like, I guess, your own design goal of let's make something that's super easy to learn for pick and pass, to it being printed out with first yourself doing your self-publishing, but then also the GameRight version?
Yeah, so I think the design process was reasonably quick because I had all of those failed set collection games in my drawer. I kind of had a bunch of stuff ready to try. So I think it was something like 6 months from the first idea to, I feel like this is pretty done. And that's quite quick for me. So it was probably about 6 months. And then I went into producing my own edition. And then I was selling that. I believe it was a GameRight found a copy quite quickly. But then there was about a year before they released it again. So 6 months of design, then another, you know, 6 months of me making my version, and then probably another year at least until the GameRight edition came out in 2014. Yep.
Oh, I mean, 2 years, that's standard, I would say.
Yeah, like I've had a lot of way, 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 way longer processes than that. So at the time, I remember waiting, that year of waiting, because I obviously had to stop kind of, so I didn't reprint my edition, obviously. So there was this kind of gap where it just wasn't anywhere. And I remember that felt like forever to me, but in hindsight, it wasn't long at all.
Do you have like a favorite and a least favorite part of the initial game's journey? I know it's been a while, so you can also include any of the Sushi Go stuff if you'd like. You got 10 years to think on.
I think the main thing that I remember from all the games is definitely designing Sushi Go Party, because I feel like that was a moment where I really pushed myself, where I really sort of committed and said to GameRight, I can do this. Let me just go away and design all these cards. And then I just had to do it, you know. And that kind of pushing myself a little outside my comfort zone felt like a big growth period for me, because I remember feeling like, okay, I've got a few months. I've got to come up with all these new cards. Go. And I just had to like try everything and try things I'd never thought about before, and it was really hard, but really rewarding. So that's probably the main thing I remember. In both games, Sushi Go and Sushi Go Party, the annoying part is the obsessing over exact point values and exact card counts in the deck. I'm not like amazingly good at the maths of game theory, so a lot of it's just brute forcing it for me. And so I can remember that feeling a bit of a slog at times.
I'm also not a math guy. I fuss with it until it feels right, and then I still have someone else check it.
And sometimes it's not, there are certain things in game design that aren't mathable, you know, because when you're talking about risking and probability and human psychology, like you can't always nail down the number value, be able to prove that's the right one. Sometimes you do have to just go, puddings should be 6 points, and it just feels it just feels in my heart that puddings should be six, and eight is too much, but six feels good, so I'll go with six.
That pudding guy is always a cutie. I always save him till the end, which is probably bad, but meh, whatever. I like to push my luck.
I think you can tell a lot about a person about how they play puddings in Sushi Go. I don't know what it tells you about them, but it must say something.
I was about to say, like, what is it saying about me?
I think people who, like, take three in the first round, they must be safety type people. You know what I mean? They need to feel safe and secure.
See, and I'm like going full sashimi and like tempura. I'm like, I'm going to push my luck. I'm going to hope for three. And then that third doesn't appear. And I'm like, well, it's been a round.
There you go. You're a risk taker. Risk taker.
Guess so. Which is funny because I feel like I'm a stable human in most places, but apparently not in games. So as far as like your games, just from like an outside perspective, you always seem to have pretty intuitive ones. Like typically you can look at the design and kind of guess how to play. Is that one of your practices that you try for in all your designs?
Definitely. Yeah. I think like I always aim for like a game that can be taught in a few minutes. So like 3 minutes, maybe five max. And a game that once taught, the rules usually stay with the players. If not, the components will reinforce them. I mean, I feel like the biggest barrier for new people getting into games so often is the rules teach and the stress that comes around having to remember rules and having to learn them quickly. So often I see that is what turns people off wanting to sit down and play a game if they don't know it already and if they don't know many games. So for whatever reason, from the very beginning, I've just thought I'd really like to make games that almost anyone can play and almost anyone can learn. So yeah, that's just something I've always tried to do, and there's some craft to it, but a lot of it is also just intuition and watching play tests and seeing where people trip up, what they can't remember, and slowly you just really learn. And even now when I'm just designing in my head or in a book, I very quickly can kind of go, you know what, this rule is gonna be a real annoying rule that trips everyone up. I can just sense it, you know, I can see it coming. Part of it is like, can I get rid of that rule? Can it just go? Or is there a version of it that is more in sync with the rest of the play?
Did that come from like a specific person or just like you yourself? Because I do very similar with my games. I try to make it so I can create them where I can teach it in like 3 minutes, or honestly, most of my games I can teach in about a minute. But that was more because of my family. Like, I've seen my mom cry trying to read a rule book out of just like frustration and not understanding. But like, if it was taught to her, like she got it, she could play it. And like, just like seeing that, like kind of hurt me. And I just wanted to make it so it was like, that is not the experience people have, because rule books aren't great. A lot of them are written pretty terribly, or like the graphics weren't utilized in the right ways. And I feel like videos made it a lot better. Like all these YouTubers out there that are doing these how to play videos are just godsends, because it has really made people be able to access board games in a different way, because it's like you're getting taught.
I think very similar. So the people I started playing games with, and a lot of the people I still play games with regularly, are just quite what you'd call casual gamers. Like they only own a few at home. They're not interested in anything over 45 minutes. And for whatever reason, they've just been the people around me, especially at the start. And I guess you end up designing for who's in front of you. And while I do like some more complex games and sometimes play games with super intense hobby people, a lot of the time I'm just playing casual games with casual people. And that's just the group I have around me. And that's kind of what I enjoy myself to mostly. So yeah, I designed for that. Quite similar to what you said.
I used to live in the Chicago area, so I had access to like heavier weight designers. And when I first started, I thought like, that's what I needed to be and what I needed to do in order to be quote unquote successful. And then later on, I realized, wait, no, like why try to be something that is not just what is baked inside of me? Because it is a lot easier for me to create these games that are more intuitive and like streamlined and quote unquote more mass market leaning, which is interesting because you're technically more hobby side, but I feel like you have more of a mass mind in some ways.
Yeah, I really relate to that. When I started, you know, I got into the hobby playing Settlers, Carcassonne, and I really liked Princes of Florence and Puerto Rico and Tigris and Euphrates. And this, you get this silly thing in your head of like, serious game design is these 90 minute Euros, and that's the real hard stuff. And this other stuff on the side is just, you know, fanciful. But that's so silly. Like, that's so silly. And I remember outgrowing that too and just going, you know what? I like making these little things. That's what I love. And people like playing them, so I'm going to keep making them. And why be, you know, elitist to yourself like that? Like, if it's what you enjoy designing and making, that's fine. And it's a really different headspace to be in. Like, playtesting my types of games with the 90-minute Euro crowd, it's like two different types of brains. And often I get almost nothing out of it because they're approaching, like you say, a more mass style game with an analytical brain. Sometimes that's not a good match. And sometimes I get more out of a playtest with some kids or with some complete non-gamers. I'll get way more out of a playtest than with other game designers or like serious game players, because there's just different elements of the craft. And when you're designing for kids or families, there's more to it than just goes into designing a more complex strategy game. There's an alchemy of just fun factor, ease of play. These things are very hard to pin down and analyze, and you just kind of slowly uncover them as you test.
Also, the base game itself, it's like, with that kind of design, you're shaving things away and trying to simplify, where like a Euro, you can just keep adding mechanics to fix problems. You can't do that when you're trying for that game that you can teach in like 3 minutes or less. And hopefully the people will always remember the rules. And I mean, for most of those types of games, what I'm just looking at is setup. And after that, it's like, got it done. Even if I had played it 3 years ago or something.
Yeah. I'm super jealous of, I was having a chat with, you know, John D. Clare. He makes more complex games than I do.
Yeah. I actually just saw him in person a few days ago at Grand Con.
And we're having a really fun chat about game design. And we were just talking about how he's like, when I face a problem, I can just put on a new mechanism or add 20 new cards. And I was like, so jealous. I was like, oh man. Because the way my design process works is it feels like I come up with a game, and then I hit it with a million sticks and break off every loose bit until there's only this tiny core left, which almost isn't a game. It's, you know, it's hardly hanging together by the few sinews of itself. It's very different to the process for other styles of designers, where the craft is about interlocking systems. And, you know, you like adding a new system might be exactly what this game needs. And that's just so different to the way I find game design to be for my stuff.
It's so funny because I was talking to him about the same thing, and how I always relate it to is cooking. It's like a designer like him can just keep adding more spices, add more ingredients, where we have to just throw away what we were working on and start all over.
Yeah. I often, it feels like to me, designing like a mass card game or a filler card game almost feels like panning for gold. It's like, I'm going to try 50 different ideas and 30 of them will prove to be really bad straight away. And then 20 of them will be okay. But then 10 of them will annoy me and won't work. And then 5 of them I'll work on for a few months. And then 3 of them will break, you know. And then finally you whittle it down to, here's a couple that are really cool, I'll keep working on these. But all these other ideas don't make it, you know, and they just get put aside really quick. So it feels more like I'm sifting through hundreds of ideas looking for the really good idea. It doesn't feel like I'm slowly building an idea. It feels like I'm throwing away ideas a lot of the time.
Yeah, but it sounds like you, at least when you throw things away, you're kind of recycling it later. Because, I mean, you brought back Sushi Go using failed experiments on set collection.
Exactly. And this is something I've only learnt the more I've designed, is that throwing a game away, it can feel bad. And it can feel like you failed. But it's actually you put good work into that, and that work may definitely resurface somewhere else. So I know when you're starting out as a designer, it's really hard to just say this isn't going to make it and put it in a drawer. It feels really bad, but you've done the work. It's still in your brain somewhere. I usually keep most of my old prototypes too. And sometimes you realize that thing you did years ago in a failed game is actually useful. Another example of that for me actually is in Baron Park, there's a mechanism in that which is when you place a tile down on your board, the icons you cover up on the board determine which pieces you take from the supply. So Baron Park came out 2017. That mechanism I had in a game in 2011. I remember because I took it to Essen in 2011 and tried to pitch it and no one wanted it. But it had that mechanism in it of covering icons to get the stuff for the next turn. And when I was designing Baron Park, it like fit like a glove, you know, and I already had it there ready to go.
I know I've definitely recycled things. And that same panel that I was talking with John on, Emerson Masucci was there too. And we got asked the question, like, how do you know when to essentially trash a prototype or like give up on it? And Emerson was like, I put it on a shelf and sometimes it resurfaces because whether it's the whole game itself with like changes or just pieces of it that he Frankensteins together into a new design, it's like never really 100% gone. And I was like thinking about it, I was like, actually, that's basically what I do because I don't keep all my prototypes. Like the really bad ones are gone, but the okay ones still there. I just pulled one out a few weeks ago because so many publishers are looking for that really easy like card game that's just numbers. And I was like, wait a sec, I made one of these like a year ago and I was just working on so many other things that got shelved. It wasn't that it was bad. It just was barely tested. And so I brought it back out.
Totally. Yeah. And I remember getting some really great advice once from Rob Davio. He said that when he puts prototypes away like that, when he's stuck, he can't finish them, time to put it in the drawer. He said he always writes himself a little note and he puts it in the box. And the note says, here's where I got stuck. Here's why this wasn't working. Because so often he would find without doing that, he'd come to an old prototype and just not remember, you know, anything. And so I think that's really great advice. So, I mean, I have prototypes from, like 10 years ago. Sitting in a drawer. And sometimes I open them and I'm just like, what? Like,
who are you?
How did this play? So I don't write a note now. What I do is all I feel like I need to do is write like a player aid card, as if it were, you know, was like the way to play on one card. Just so it's like when I open the box, it's like, oh yeah, this is what this game is. This is why it works, how it works. And usually why it didn't work comes back to me pretty quickly. I started doing it because I did have a few examples of opening up old boxes and just going, I don't remember how to play. I don't remember what this is.
That's so funny. Yeah, Jonathan Gilmore will do similar but not put anything in it and then try to play it from how he thought the rules were. And then a lot of times he'll then compare it to the rules that he has like saved digitally somewhere and see like how off he was and see if it was more fun or less fun.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm really bad with writing rules. Like, I never, ever write any rules down in any form until I need to, which is basically when I'm pitching it to a company, which is probably really bad practice. But there's something about, I don't know why, I just keep it in my head. And I really should get better at writing rules down because I have forgotten some games.
Well, how many games are you working on at a time? Like, is it just one or two? Because I think it would depend on that, on keeping everything in your head.
Yeah. Well, so I have a Trello board. You know Trello? It's just like a task organization kind of app thing. So I'm currently in kind of full on, the game is signed and I'm developing it with the publisher. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, I'd say 5 games in development with publishers. Then games that I've got in develop, like I'm kind of far along in the process, but haven't pitched it yet, I would say another 5. And then in terms of like my ideas list, which is the list of, it's prototyped, it's early, but it's very early, you know, that kind of feeling. Like, I don't know if this will be a game yet, but I'm kind of started. That's, I've got about 20 of those, which is probably too many.
Nah, I mean, that's about what I do. So, but also, I'm not a good judgment on that.
Like, scrolling down that list, it's like, oh, I probably need to decide what to do with some of these. But yeah, I generally have a lot of stuff going at once. But again, my games are, I think part of the reason I don't write down the rules is probably some weird mind game I'm playing with myself, which is if I can't remember them, that's a bad sign, you know? Like if I can't just remember the rules, something's up with the way it's working. Yeah.
No, that totally makes sense. Speaking of those projects on your Trello board, are any of them ones you can talk about and kind of say that fans should be looking out for?
Yeah, I think so. So one which I've just finished work on, and it's been announced, so I can talk about it, is a game called Sinister Institute, which is coming out from Mojito Games, and it's a co-op, and it's about a, like, it's kind of like, imagine Hogwarts mixed with Wednesday Addams' school.
Honestly, I'm so in, because I liked both those.
So it's like a school for kids who do magic, but it's like a bit dark and creepy, set in a swamp, and yeah, it's really cool. So it's aimed at, like, it's kind of like 10, like 9 to 10 kind of years old co-op game. I originally tried to design a, like, 3-hour adventure game and, like, a really sprawling, like, complicated adventure game, and this is what it became. It became, like, a 40-minute game for 10-year-olds. But yeah, it's a co-op about going on little quests and finding objects and sharing them with each other and defeating the evil sorcerer. So that's kind of the one I've just pretty much finished and has been announced.
That sounds very cute and so different from, like, Super Mega Lucky Box or any of your other games.
Yeah, yeah. This is my most thematic game by far, I would say. Like, you sort of... Yeah, it's actually themed, and you feel like you are characters in a world going on quests.
I've noticed, like, you do a little co-design, but it seems like you more do solo. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, so when I started, I was the only game designer I knew at all, because there wasn't a scene at all when I started here in Australia, really. There was a couple of other people just starting out, but not in my city. Now there's, like, quite a healthy game design scene here, but when I started, there was no one. So collaboration really never even crossed my mind. And then about 5 years ago, I just saw so many cool people doing so many great collaborations that I thought I should give it a try, you know? So it just started. So the main person I've collaborated with is Matthew Dunstan, who is Australian too, but for most of the time I've known him, he's lived in Europe. But we just kind of click, I think, as a little team. And I've also collaborated with other people, so Eric Lang and Steve Finn. But I'm still kind of figuring out, like, every collaboration is so different for me. I don't think I've quite figured it out yet. Like, everyone has been so radically different. It's like, oh, I can't quite pin down how a collaboration's going to feel. You don't know till you start. Like, it's really interesting. It's like a weird mystery how each one goes. One thing I do feel, though, I'm finding, probably this is one of the many things that COVID kind of ruined for us all, is, like, designing remotely. So for me, living in Australia, some of those designers I mentioned just live in the other hemisphere. And designing remotely, kind of COVID gave us a lot of tools to do that better, like Tabletop Simulator kind of took off and stuff. And you can really do it. And it was, like, such a blessing for that time. But I'm really sort of feeling like, oh, man, like, I want to be in the room with people. And it's hard when you live in Sydney, Australia. There's not, you know, if you want to collaborate with big designers, you need to accept that you'll have a 14-hour time difference some of the time. So it's a bit tricky. But, yeah, each one has been good, but just for different reasons.
That totally makes sense. Most of my co-designs are also digital, which is interesting, especially since I lean towards either party games or very intuitive, like, entry-level games. I like being with people.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So it's like most of our playtests are like, we do them separately with our own groups and report back and have a spreadsheet or have like a Google sheet, or we just get on calls or whatever it is. I also am an energized toddler, so I have a tendency to be doing like 5 playtests to their 1 playtest.
Whoa, that sounds great. Yeah, I think I really realized, so I've been designing, so Wrath of Fire Mountain is a game I did with Eric Lang, which is just came out. And we were working on that for a long time, doing what you described, like doing our own playtests and then meeting on Zoom and using a bit of Tabletop Simulator. We couldn't quite finish it. Like, we couldn't quite get the last, you know, 5% absolutely locked in. And we happened to be at a convention in person together for a week. And in that 1 week, we like pretty much got it all sorted out. And I don't think it would have ever, like, I think we just needed to be together to churn through that last kind of problem solving part of the design. Remote is cool, but I think I'm really realizing how valuable that face-to-face time is as well.
Oh, for sure. Honestly, I was at a game design retreat a few weeks ago and I loved it. And I was like, oh my God, I need to just start doing this. And it was all with women. And I don't have any co-designs with women that are published. And I was like, you know, it really sucks when I'm constantly saying how much I want more female designers when I have no co-designers that are women. They're all like older guys. And I was like, And I don't know why, if it's like because that's who I click with or if that's who's like available or just like fits what I am missing in my design sensibilities. But it's like, oh, I just need to do like some retreats and just like shove myself in a building with people and see what comes out of it. I don't know. Or make a board game commune. I don't know.
There's something about that energy being together. So Matt Dunstan recently moved back to Australia. So we've done lots of remote designing and he recently moved back. And so now every second Friday we hang out and design together. It's like amazing to me. Like, it's like I have this whole day where we just get to talk and churn out ideas and bounce ideas off each other and test stuff. And I've never really had that at all when I travel to the States, or you end up in a city and you realize there's this like amazing design scene there. And like, there's like 50 designers and they all hang out all the time. Like, Toronto seems like a hot spot.
Oh, I go to Toronto twice a year for that reason. Same with DC. They have a great one. Chicago's got a great one. New York has a great one. I visit all the little pockets and I get so jealous. And if only they were in cheaper cities that I could live at, or not Canada, because, you know, unless a Canadian wants to marry me, I don't think I'm moving there anytime soon.
Yeah. And like, there are designers in Australia, but our capital cities are all also 8 to 12 hours away from each other. So it's like not easy to like get a scene happening as it is in North America, I think. But it's definitely been growing and growing and growing. And, but yeah, it's hard not to feel jealous when you're in near the Toronto people.
I know we talked about a lot of different advices of things, but was there anything you would want to tell a designer that we didn't already talk about that you think would be good for them, like starting out in design or designing more simplified games like you do?
Yeah, some things I find myself saying a lot are when you're starting out, like finishing a game is really important. It is really easy to make your first design a bit of a pet project that you want to be perfect and you want to keep working on it till it's amazing. But sometimes just saying, I'm done, this is finished, and I'm going to give it to some friends or put it online as a print and play, or something like that, and just get it out there, like get people playing it and it being done, is really important. Because the kind of feedback loop you go through with a done game, even if it's just, you know, I made 20 copies and I sent them to friends and family, you learn so much from the game being done and everyone reacting to it. And it can be hard. It can be hard at the start, but it's so valuable. When I meet a lot of new designers, sometimes they're just kind of a bit stuck with that first design, you know, and they're just trying and trying and trying to make it their magnum opus and their brilliant debut and all that kind of thing. And sometimes it's good to just put something out and just start getting that feedback. And in terms of simple games, like, it's a hard thing to learn. Like, that, like we were talking before, often you feel like you're whittling away rather than building. So it's a hard skill to teach. It's just something you learn by doing, and it's something you learn by very close attention to playtest groups, not so much what they're saying to you, but how they're acting at the table and how much visible engagement and fun you see. And it's something about leaning into those, learning to lean into those moments. And I would also just say, like, play a lot of like mass market games and older games, and just keep an open mind about where you might find a cool idea. Because sometimes, like, a really simple, great game is just like the idea. And you know, when you land on that idea, you know it's going to take work, but you know there's a good game there. And I think that's what happened with Sushi Go. When I gave myself that little design challenge, you know, seven wonders, but for my mom, or whatever I told myself, I was like, oh, I can see this as a product in the world. Like, I can see it existing on a shelf. I can see it being played and enjoyed. Now I've just got to go make it. So sometimes it's just about searching for those cool ideas and landing on them, and then just committing to like getting it done.
Definitely. I found that also testing with the group it's intended for is great, because like I live in a nowhere's land of no designers, and so I also don't have too many like actual, I need to stop saying actual gamers, but like people who play in the hobby and like play games regularly. I have a lot of people that are like, oh yeah, like I'll play a game if you put it next to me, but they wouldn't like ever choose to do that on their own. Those are more the people that I play games with, and I found that very valuable because they haven't played a ton of mechanics. Like, I'm constantly introducing the concepts of these mechanics that they would never even need to know the name of, because why would they?
Yeah, I think a big mistake, like, if you are making games, like we were talking about before, is a big feeling that's like, I'm going to take this game and show it to the 10 game designers I know, or the 10 really great hobby gamers I know, and get their feedback, you know. But they might actually not be the type of person who knows what makes a mass market card game great, you know. Maybe some kids, you know, or some family members who only play Uno. Maybe they actually know intuitively what makes a game like that great, better than, you know, this amazing game designer who you know from somewhere else. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's playing with the target audience and sort of trusting their gut reactions when you playtest. I think that's a big part of it, yeah.
Yeah. I know I think I've become a better designer since getting put into a nowhere's land and being forced to test with people that aren't like my game design groups that I was seeing every single week, and really learning to watch my playtesters more than have them answer the questions I was asking. Because like other designers know how to answer playtest questions because they ask those questions. But like a random person you meet at your rock climbing gym who was nice enough to like sit down and play your game after climbing is not going to know how to explain what they liked or didn't like. They're just going to say like, I liked it or I didn't like it. And then you're going to just need to know from watching them, like, why didn't they like it? Because, well, they stumbled at X part, or like during this one piece, like they played the wrong card and they didn't know why they played the wrong card because they thought it was the right move. Like they had a strategy they thought was the prevalent strategy. And it's like watching them, you can generate your questions. Like I've never used a pre-written question form. I just like come up with questions as I'm watching my playtesters, because I'll notice them do something and then I later want to ask why they did it or why they didn't understand it. Or if I thought they cheated, I don't tell them they cheated. I just like tell them later like what they did.
I think that's a really similar process to me with testing. All the other stuff, like the math, the balancing, the refining, the numbers, etc., like that, you can do that later. Like that will happen, and you might get advice from different people for that. But knowing the game is like hitting the target with the audience is way more visceral than that. It's like watching playtests, seeing people. Often it's they ask to play again, or they ask when it will be available. Like those sorts of things you're looking for. Like, okay, this work. Like this is it. I might need to then go away and like iterate on it for a long time to get the numbers all right or whatever it is. But that knowing that the idea is sort of singing with the people who are going to play it, that's something you sort of have to witness, I think.
Oh, for sure. I still have this funny thing when someone's like, I want to play it again. I like am both super happy, but also like, but no, I want to test another different game. But I'm like, all right, we'll play it again.
Ah, yes. Well, that can be the problem.
It's a good problem, though.
A skill I've learned slowly is like playtest group management. And not burning out anyone, particularly if you're married to them or related to them, like getting a sense of like, okay, like I won't ask you to this playtest night. You've been to the last two. You deserve a break.
Well, here, for my last question that was unrelated to anything we've already talked about, if you could have designed a game that you weren't the designer of, which game would it have been?
I ended up saying this exact thing to someone last year, so I guess I should admit to it and use that example. There's obviously a lot of games I wish I had designed, but I met the Flat Out Games team for the first time last year.
Oh, I love them.
So Molly, and Sean and Robert. Molly Johnson, Robert Melvin, Sean Stankovich, yes. So I met them last year for the first time and have really loved what they're doing since they started. When Point Salad came out, I had been forever trying to make a card game where you're collecting some stuff and then you're collecting a bunch of cards which just tell you how to score that stuff. I wanted to make like a really minimalist card game, and that was it. I'm collecting, you know, five different icons and also telling you how to score those icons on some cards. And that I just had this idea. I was trying, you know, 20 or 30 different iterations over many years of could I make this work? Anyway, I remember listening to, it might have been a Dice Tower podcast or something like that when the game first came out, and they were talking about this great new game, Point Salad, and all they did was describe it in like two sentences about how Point Salad works, and I literally remember going, damn it, like they did it. Like that was it. That was it. Like having the scoring rules on the back of the resource cards and then having them flip down into the row, and then you can take from the row or you can take from the top. I was just like, that's it. That's what I was, it really felt like that's what I was trying to find, and they found it. And since that game came out, I was just like, okay, I'm done with that idea. They did it.
It's perfect. I don't need to do it.
They did it really, yeah. They did it. It's done. And I kind of felt a bit of relief too. But I said that when I met them, that was the first thing I said. I was just like, Point Salad. Like, I think it's because I was so clearly working on that idea and they found the solution. It feels like the most like, oh, I wish I got there, you know? So that's probably the one I would have to say.
No, I think that's a great answer. It's a great game. Their second one was also good too. Well, I appreciate everyone who's been listening to this, the episode that is 100, aka Sushi Go. And thanks again, Phil, for being on here. We've talked about a lot of really cool stuff, including Sushi Go, as well as all the design stuff that we have in common and that I'm sure a lot of other designers feel similar about. But if someone's trying to find you online, where can you be reached or followed?
The best place is probably just my website, philwalkerharding.com. Where you can see stuff about all my games. I've got like mini design diaries on there, and you can contact me through there as well.
Sweet. And then if you're trying to find me, Danielle Reynolds, you can find me under Token Gamer, and that's GAYMER for Instagram, X, Blue Sky, and then I guess I have a website. It's dmrcreativegroup.com. I'm okay at updating it. Thank you so much, Phil, for being on the show.
That was really great. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.